Welcome to episode 7 of The Short Way Home. I'm your host, Michael Chin. This podcast is released in conjunction with my new book, The Long Way Home, from Cowboy Jamboree Press. Cowboy Jamboree Press, good grit lit, home to forthcoming titles, including William R. Sultan's Lost in the Furrows. Thank you to Adam Van Winkle, a founder and general editor over at Cowboy Jamboree, for not only his collaboration on bringing my new book into the world, but for the art for the book cover, as well as this podcast artwork. You can learn more at cowboyjamboreemagazine.com. So in this episode, I'm focusing on Mr. Perfect versus Ric Flair. This is a match that occurred on January 25th, 1993. It was the third ever episode of Monday Night Raw, which is pretty wild to think about. Now there's been well over 1,000 episodes. You know, that show, it's been on for, if I'm recording this, over 27 years. So for this to be, you know, only the third ever episode, you know, just really they're kind of figuring out, you know, what this show is at that time. It's still happening at the Manhattan Center, which only houses about 1,500 people. So, you know, small, intimate kind of show, especially, you know, relative to the kind of Raws that we tend to see, you know, excluding shows that happen during this coronavirus period. But, you know, ordinarily, you know, when things are kind of business as usual, Raw nowadays is happening in, you know, 10,000 plus seat venues. So this is a, you know, a pretty small production. Also of note, this is happening the night after Royal Rumble 1993, and that's not necessarily a super celebrated Rumble or Rumble event. The Rumble match itself, I don't think it was a bad one per se, but it wasn't a great one either. There's no real standout iconic performance from it. Yokozuna wins in a way that I guess, you know, super heavyweights should win that match every now and again, just to reinforce kind of the obvious natural physical advantage they have in that sort of environment. But nonetheless, it kind of felt like there was no obvious star to really push coming out of that Rumble, aside from Yokozuna, who had been pushed pretty heavily, just kind of going over in squash matches up to that point, and was positioned as a challenger to Bret Hart. Bret Hart did successfully defend the world title against Razor Ramon at that Royal Rumble event in a pretty good match. You know, and one that kind of furthers, you know, Hart's story and kind of the narrative of him as a working champion and, you know, someone who was putting on great matches, even though he didn't have, the star power of someone, you know, like his predecessor Hulk Hogan or like, you know, Steve Austin would as kind of the next, you know, kind of, you know, explosively over, face of the company. But that's just sort of setting the scene here, the stage of kind of, you know, where WWE was at this point. So Perfect versus Flair, it was billed as a career match, which is pretty interesting. To my knowledge, only the second one I'm aware of, at least in that era of WWE, after the Ultimate Warrior versus Randy Savage at WrestleMania 7. And it's some pretty high stakes, right? We think about, you know, matches that have, you know, titles on the line. That's a pretty well-defined stake. There's number one contenders matches. There's all kinds of grudge matches that happen, you know, in steel cages or, you know, with other gimmicks. The career match gimmick kind of applied to this match feels like a big deal, right? Because it sells the idea that one of these guys has to retire after he loses. And of course, neither guy was actually going to retire. You know, kind of the real life narrative here is that Ric Flair was leaving WWE to go back to WCW. This is a way of kind of writing him off. But in that era, the way WWE kind of operated, they were setting it up that Flair was just going to be gone from the wrestling landscape altogether because, as far as they were concerned, WWE was all that existed. So, you know, a big high stakes match, and had a real story behind it. You know, I think they rushed a little bit to get to this point, to have this match on that episode of Raw, but the story between Perfect and Flair, what was a really long standing one. These guys had been kind of partners in crime for a long time. When Ric Flair came in, he sort of had a small entourage. He had Bobby Heenan and he had Mr. Perfect, both in non-wrestling kind of manager roles. And you know, little by little, Heenan kind of, you know, made that transition to being a full-time broadcaster, but was kind of Flair's cheerleader, you know, throughout all of his efforts. And Perfect was his corner man, and kind of de facto manager. I think they called him a consultant, was his official title. but you know, did all the physical kind of stuff in terms of interfering in matches and kind of helping Flair, you know, capture and retain the WWE Championship. So, you know, they were pretty well attached for most of Flair's run in WWE and that first tenure he had with the company. And then he split off. So it was the Survivor Series 1992. One of the top billed matches was supposed to be, you know, kind of an all-star encounter, but it was going to be Randy Savage and the Ultimate Warrior up against Ric Flair and Razor Ramon. And in terms of, you know, star power, I mean, Savage, Warrior, and Flair are, you know, three of the biggest names you can get, especially that this was WWE really moving on from the Hulk Hogan era. He hadn't appeared since WrestleMania 8. And then Ramon was kind of a rising star, right? He was, you know, a relatively fresh face in WWE still at that point. They were building him to challenge for the world title at Royal Rumble. So, you know, that was kind of a marquee match. But then, you know, the stories vary a little bit, but the crux of what happened was the Ultimate Warrior left the company fairly unexpectedly with fairly little notice, and WWE ended up subbing in Mr. Perfect in his place, which felt like a big deal because Perfect hadn't actually wrestled the match since SummerSlam 1991, so you know, so it was a big return for him and a big face turn. They just did it over the course of a primetime wrestling, which was the Monday Night show to precede Monday Night Raw, which is mostly a studio show. So Savage invited Perfect to be his partner, and Flair and Bobby Heenan were kind of laughing it off, like, no way he's going to do that. That's just ridiculous to ask. And kind of a subtext that, you know, he wouldn't stand a chance if he were to join your team. So why would he even consider it? Which Mr. Perfect takes exception to, and that ends up, you know, goading him into the return and helping Savage win at Survivor Series. And then the feud is on with Perfect and Flair. You know, I think in sort of a perfect world, this match, you know, it could have happened at the Royal Rumble pay-per-view, or they could have saved it for WrestleMania 9, which was happening, you know, that spring. But I think just, you know, in terms of, you know, trying to push Monday Night Raw as a new show and try to have something important happen there, and, you know, and break the mold of it just being, you know, all squash matches, but to really have a big time competitive match with high stakes, it made sense to have Perfect versus Flair there. And I assume there was something contractually where Flair was on the way out the door sooner rather than later. And so, you know, needed to kind of get this match done. And from WWE's perspective, send Flair out, where he's putting over someone else to be a bigger star. So with this, it's an interesting match to watch now. You know, I've rewatched it a couple times since it's become available on the WWE Network. And so the commentary team is the first thing I'll make mention of. It's Vince McMahon doing the play-by-play, Bobby Heenan on color commentary, and Rob Bartlett kind of along for the ride. And if the Rob Bartlett name doesn't sound super familiar to those wrestling fans listening, he was a comedian and a radio personality whom WWE kind of experimented with bringing in as an additional, I guess you could call him a color commentator, but he didn't really have much color to add on commentary there. And it's sort of a funny thing that, you know, he sounds sort of out of place at points. You know, he makes sort of a quick joke almost, when Ric Flair, gouges, Mr. Perfect's eyes and, you know, says, yeah, you're going to put an eye out. And it sort of just feels out of place for what's a, you know, pretty serious, match situation. And later on, Vince actually calls out Bartlett and says, you've been awfully quiet over there. In a way that, you know, I think on the surface level, and as any fan watching at the time would probably see it as just, you know, Bartlett literally hasn't said very much in a little while, so we're gonna, you know, just call on him. But, you know, in knowing things now, you know, knowing that Vince McMahon is, you know, pulling all of the strings and is Bartlett's boss in reality, it feels an awful lot like McMahon actually just sort of talking to him and being like, you're not pulling your weight here, say something. Which just, it's, you know, just sort of interesting to consider from a perspective now. McMahon is now kind of notorious for, you know, being in the headsets of whoever's on commentary and kind of, you know, feeding them lines and criticizing them while they're talking. And so to hear him kind of, you know, make that aside to Bartlett there feels pretty pointed in that moment. But in any event, you know, the match itself, you know, it's solid as you would expect from, you know, two guys who are generally regarded as, two of the best of all time, certainly two of the best of that generation of performers. Ric Flair sometimes gets criticized for being a routine man, which means that he would repeat a lot of the same spots in a lot of his matches. To the point it could get kind of predictable that, you know, somebody's going to, you know, throw him into the corner and he's going to do a flip over it and run to the other side and they're going to cut him off. And that spot does happen in slightly unconventional fashion in this match, but still the basic structure is there. We know he's going to work the knee and which moves he's going to use to do that. And we know he's going to put the figure four leg lock on. We know he's going to beg off. We know he's going to flop. You know, all of these kind of signature Ric Flair things that he does in, you know, so many of his matches, especially high-profile ones. You know, and it's interesting. This is something that Conrad Thompson, who's, you know, now Flair's son-in-law, kind of explains in the podcast he does with Eric Bischoff and with Bruce Pritchard and others, where he talks about basically that Flair, you know, he was beholden to this routine stuff, but the rationale wasn't, you know, just sort of being lazy or, you know, relying on a very specific playbook, but more so that he knew this was sort of the iconic stuff for him. This is stuff the fans came to see and remembered his own, you know, youth as a wrestling fan, and how you know, if he went to see the matches live, he expected to see the greatest hits. He wanted to see kind of the signature stuff of his favorite wrestlers. And so he does the same stuff in service of that, of people who are coming to see a Ric Flair match and want to see the Ric Flair spots. You know, he feels that's kind of his obligation to live up to it. So, you know, it's a really good match. There are moments where it's kind of sloppy, and I think it's sort of a sign of the times. You know, there's things like, you know, when Perfect is on his, you know, kind of hot babyface comeback, he sort of misses this one punch, you know, pretty wildly swinging over Flair's head, and Flair still sells it. And then there's that spot where Flair jumps off the top rope, and, you know, he almost always gets caught, and this time Henning just kind of jumps up and gives him sort of an awkward punch, which doesn't seem like that was quite what was supposed to happen. So little bits of awkwardness that I think are largely just kind of a sign of the times, that there weren't kind of these, you know, flawlessly executed, kind of overly scrutinized matches in that era. You know, nowadays we sort of expect that, you know, some people are recording an episode of Raw, and that's going to, and clips that are going to show up on YouTube. And so, you know, everything needs to be pretty perfect. And in that era, you know, we have a TV show air, and that's probably it. There are a handful of hardcore fans who are going to, you know, make VHS recordings of it. But for the by and large, you know, wrestling population, you know, no one's going to see this again, you know, having no idea that, you know, 20 however many years later, there's going to be a WWE network where people are going to be able to stream this thing. But I will say, you know, aside from those bits of, you know, sloppiness, you know, Mr. Perfect's comeback towards the end of this match is really solid. He sells kind of the almost hulking up, you know, just really righteously pissed off face who kind of no-sells Flair's offense for the last 5 minutes or so, and just goes after him. And there's a really sharp finish where they do an Irish whip spot and Flair bends over for a back body drop, and Perfect just counters it right into a Perfect Plex. And that's just really sharp for the pin. And there's a fun moment where, you know, it's the difference between, you know, Rob Bartlett and Bobby Heenan in this context, where Bartlett was just kind of, you know, out of place and didn't know kind of how to land a comedy spot in this context. Heenan, you know, has been such an advocate for Flair throughout his WWE tenure, you know, gives one of the iconic performances in the 1992 Rumble when Flair goes the distance and wins. In this case, it's kind of a nice bookend to it. He sort of just stands up, and they bleep it out to sort of comedic effect, where it's implied that he lets out this string of expletives that he's so upset that Flair has lost. And it's really great and entertaining in that moment. So the whole match, I looked this up online because it's hard to tell how long it is with commercial breaks and whatnot edited out. From the online results, I found clocks in around 23 minutes. And it's interesting because that's really long for a TV match in that era, and especially one that's worked at any kind of pace at all. But it is one of those things where I think, you know, as a young fan, you know, as a elementary school kid, when this happened, I sort of thought this was a great match. And looking back at it now, I think it's very good, but I wouldn't call it great. You know, I think it's, you know, especially by the standards of its time, you know, a very strong match, one that stands out. But if we're to put it in kind of the pantheon of, you know, Ric Flair matches or Curt Hennig, Mr. Perfect matches, or just great matches, WWE all around, it doesn't really rate, right? It's hard to say that this is, you know, a top 100 match. maybe in free TV matches of WWE, and you know, maybe if we narrow the lens to just the 1990s, something like that, it would fare better. But in the big scheme of things, it doesn't necessarily age as well. And it's one of those things where I think as a young fan, especially at that point when I was kind of starting to mature as a fan to some extent, I sort of equated long matches with good matches. And I think that if anything, this one is probably a little bit overlong. I think if they skimmed off about 5 minutes, it very well might have been a sharper match and kind of just more consistently strong. But nonetheless, one that's worth watching, if only for just kind of the fact that I think it really goes under noticed nowadays. Again, I don't think it's necessarily an all-time great match, but I think in terms of kind of historically important matches, particularly for being Flair's last match of his first WWE run, it is worth seeking out, especially if you have a network subscription. But okay, so with that, I'm going to switch gears here and read a piece from The Long Way Home. This piece is called The Dream. So it was originally published with a publication called Your One Phone Call. And it's the very last piece from the Autopsy and Everything After section of the book, as well as the chapbook that shares a name with it, where it appeared previously. Okay, The Dream. The ring arrives, 20 by 20, surrounded by fans, not just hundreds, thousands of them, who spent their grocery money, their rent money to be here, on the promise of a good show, the kind of show they'll remember. The kind of show that inspires people. I'm in that ring. I can't see my opponent's face, only the shining gold belt around his waist. Sometimes his face comes into focus. A peckerhead like Freddie Phelps, the kind of guy I'd relish beating, not only to win the title, but to take it from him. Sometimes it's a legend. Ric Flair transported through time, wearing his old school big gold belt, the 10 pounds of gold. There are big TV cameras around the ring, and as we lock up in that first collar and elbow tie-up, he asks me, "You ready, big man?" Sometimes it's ghost, returned, tangible, ready to work. Sometimes it's a friend, Martin LaRue or New York Nick Nettles. I think it's best then, less a sensation of taking than having something given to me, because there's no disagreement that I earned it. And I lock in my hold, the autopsy. He cries out his surrender, and the referee's prosthetic hand catches my wrist and raises my arm in victory. He hands me the gold, and everyone's there. I mean everyone. All the boys, past and present, and Dragon Princess. She's all around me and smells like lavender and cream, and then like the cotton candy my old man bought me when I was a kid and went to my first wrestling show, and I thought the world champion was the most important man in the world. A treasure, a hero. And Dad is there, Cowboy Sam too, looking on like Obi-Wan and Yoda from the rafters. It's everything. My life is complete. And I wake, not with a goofy grin, not with sorrow because it was all a dream. I wake up with a rumbling from deep within me, ages old, of a man unfulfilled and aching to get what's his. I wake up hungry. Okay. Thank you for listening. The Long Way Home is available from Cowboy Jamboree Press, distributed through Amazon. Follow me on Twitter at Mike T. Chin or visit miketchin.com for more details.